In an India where extremism, corruption, and extreme inequality reign, what happens to people's dreams for a better life?
I was interested in how the great injustice of such a society is that it forces you into a place where you believe that either you can rise or somebody else can rise. You don't see ways in which you can lift everybody up. It pits individuals against one another. And that temptation to rise above others in this hugely unequal society is a great temptation.
Then rural America isn't just poverty, opioid addiction, and despair.
What I saw was something in terms of rural life that was very different from what I was hearing in the sort of dominant narrative that we all hear so much about around rural America as a place of hopelessness and despair. And I wanted to look more into that.
We talk with Gigi Georges about Down East, Five Main Girls, and the Unseen Story of Rural America. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. India is often called the world's biggest democracy, but is that still true? India today is a country in the grip of extremism that promotes anti-Muslim hatred and is riddled by corruption. In such a society, income inequality worsens and the poor are ever more desperate. Yet they, like everyone, aspire to a better life. But what is the price of betterment in a system run on the principle of divide and conquer? The moral dilemmas that arise are at the heart of Megha Majumdar's electrifying debut novel, A Burning. It's about three unforgettable characters who seek to rise to the middle class, to political power, to fame in the movies, and find their lives entangled in the wake of a catastrophe in contemporary India. A Burning was named a New York Times notable book and is an honoree on the National Book Award long list. USA Today called it a gripping thriller with compassionate social commentary. Megha Majumdar was born and raised in Kolkata, India. She moved to the U.S. to attend college at Harvard University and works as an associate editor at Catapult. Megha Majumdar, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
A Burning. This is a searing novel. It's a tragic novel and the kind of tragedy that has to be read. But before we start talking about the book, I'd actually like to ask you to tell us a bit about yourself. You grew up in Kolkata and you write with such authenticity of the life of the poor of India. Tell us about a little bit of your own history and how you came to be so familiar with this.
So you're right. I grew up in Kolkata in India. It's a huge city. And I have lived in the U.S. Since I moved here for undergrad. So I've been here for a while now. And part of what I found really fun for the book was revisiting the places and textures that I grew up with, that I know so well, and really thinking about neighborhoods and markets and trains and all of these different scenes in Kolkata, not just for their, you know, physical qualities or what they look like, but also thinking about the kind of hidden logic of each place, you know, the kind of humor that I saw people have in response to daily problems, the kind of determination and grit and spirit. It was all part of the place for me growing up, and it was all part of what I wanted to bring to the page as well.
And I think you did that really effectively, really brilliantly. But as you point out in this novel, as one is very aware of, the vast chasm between the life of even the middle class, I mean, forget the rich, even the middle class and the poor is so great. Did you come from a poor background? Did you know people who did? How did you become so familiar with what it was like to live as somebody who's poor in India?
I grew up middle class, so I have only been a witness. But if you go to, you know, a place like India, you realize that there's just things that you grow up noticing, you know. For instance, when I was a kid and going to school in my school bus, I would look out the window and see all of these other kids who were washing dishes by the roadside because they worked at these little roadside restaurants. And then when we went to the tailor, which was very common when I was a kid, you didn't have so many stores selling ready-made clothes that you bought. You bought fabric and then you went to the tailor to get them made. So when we went to the tailor, the tailor's apprentice would be a very young person, my age. And so you grow up knowing that there are people who have very different lives. You grow up very, very conscious of the privilege that you have as a middle-class person who is going to school and whose focus can be books and exams. You realize that not everybody lives that way. So it is really something that you grow up with.
And the novel, A Burning, centers on three characters. One is Jeevan, a Muslim girl from the slums in a big city. There is Lovely, who is a transgender woman who is called, I guess in India, is called a hijra.
Mm-hmm.
And she's trying to start a career in acting. And finally, there's PT, sir, which I assume stands for physical therapy, sir. Is that right?
It's physical training, actually. I think in the U.S. it's called PE, physical education, but or gym. But we used to call that class PT class.
Physical training, sir. He's an athletic teacher in a girls' school. Tell us a bit about each of these characters and the connection between them.
You know, I was thinking about the big question for this book, which for me was, how do people live with ambition and humor and spirit in a time of rising extremism around them? And the three characters felt like ways for me to ask that question in different ways. And the central character, for instance, is somebody who, you know, she just wants to rise to the middle class. She wants to do better than her parents were able to. She has a job at a mall. She enjoys her new smartphone, but she gets into big trouble because of a politically risky comment that she makes on Facebook. And then it becomes a battle between her narrative and the narrative which is imposed on her by the state. And she finds that these two other people, her former gym teacher, who we call PD Sir, and her neighbor, Lovely, these two people are in a position where they can help her. And they have to decide whether they will sacrifice their own dreams, their own ambitions in order to seek justice for this other person or not. So I think that kind of complicated moral space where you think about, am I going to reach for my dream? What am I going to compromise? You know, where are my ethical centers? Those questions were very interesting to me when I was writing these characters.
And as you point out, being able to realize your dreams while keeping your ethical compass is very difficult in a country in which extremism is taking over and corruption. I mean, really, there's a link between extremism and corruption that becomes quite evident in this book. Could you talk about that?
I think, you know, these are problems that we see all over the world. We see them right here in the US. We certainly see them in India. We see them in many countries around the world. And I was interested in how the great injustice of such a society is that it forces you into a place where you believe that either you can rise or somebody else can rise. You don't see ways in which you can lift everybody up. It pits individuals against one another, you know? So you're forced, for example, the character of P.T. Sir, the gym teacher who becomes involved in the workings of a right-wing political party. And, you know, he's somebody who gets a little taste of political power, and he has to decide whether he will give up a lot of his morals in order to climb up this ladder and gain more political power. And that temptation to rise above others in this hugely unequal society is a great temptation.
Right.
And that temptation to rise above others in this hugely unequal society is a great temptation.
I mean, when he gets a kind of job in the party that involves framing innocent people, first of all, I wanted to know, is this a real thing in India? And if so, you know, just tell us more about that.
Well, I am no kind of legal scholar. So, you know, this was me as a fiction writer thinking about what kind of act might this school teacher be recruited for. So it's something I imagined. But I did want to think about, you know, what kind of respectability, what kind of sheen of legitimacy might a school teacher bring to a space like a courtroom where it's one narrative against another. You see all of the, you know, the interests of this book, I think, which definitely include class and class mobility. The courtroom where you have competing narratives, that's a space where that definitely comes into play. And I was interested in that.
You also have a number of what you call interludes in the book, which are little vignettes that shine a light on a different aspect of what is going on in India. And by the way, I wanted to say, I assume that the party in question, the JKP, is an analog to the BJP of Narendra Modi. Is that correct?
Well, I wrote a novel, so I'll let readers draw their own conclusions.
Well, I don't think you have to be too coy about that one. It seems like a pretty direct connection. So, yeah, tell us about these interludes and give us an example of one of them and, you know, why you included them in the book.
Part of what was really important to me when I was writing this book was complexity. So I was always thinking about how can I make this world richer and more complex? How can I resist having any character who feels flat or who functions just as a device to move the plot forward or, you know, enable something for a different character? And so these interludes, which are just short chapters of one or two pages, they follow minor characters for a little bit. And I felt like, for instance, there's one interlude where we follow a lawyer who finds himself very stressed by the different political pressures that he's getting on this case, as well as by his unmanageable workload. And he visits a spiritual guru that he follows and, you know, believes in. And so it gives us a sense of who he is and his worries, his concerns, his ambitions. And I hope that these interludes help the reader open further doors within this narrative so that they can kind of peek in and realize that this book follows three main characters, but this world is so full of stories. You could follow any of these characters and have a whole new book.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Megha Majumdar about her terrific debut novel, A Burning. It follows three characters in today's India, one a young Muslim woman falsely accused of terrorism, and two others who must choose between justice and self-interest. Right, and one of those interludes is actually the massacre of a Muslim neighbor who is accused of killing a cow. Another interlude is it's titled "A Policeman Fired for Excessive Violence During Slum Demolition Has a New Gig," and that new gig is in fact accusing Muslim lorry drivers of transporting cows and then beating them. So talk about this in the context of what is going on in India at this time.
Well, I think anybody who has been following the news in India will know that in recent years there has been an uptick in violence. And part of that has been, you know, violence against ordinary Muslim people who are accused of killing cows. And cows, of course, are sacred in Hinduism. So, you know, I am no sociologist, and I think anybody who's reading the news can find out for themselves what's been happening and realize that some of these episodes in the book are very much inspired by what I was reading in the news as well.
Right. I mean, I think it seemed that the book was really about bringing awareness of what is really going on in India. I mean, you follow the characters are very compelling, but the message of the book is also quite stark. In fact, you know, I thought to myself that as I was reading it that, you know, India is called the biggest democracy in the world, but it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of democracy left in India at this time.
You know, one could say the same about the U.S. It's
of course. I mean, we're not singling out India here, but this book is, I think, has a lesson for us here in the U.S. I mean, Modi is like the Trump of India.
Well, you know, I think that a novel is greater than a message. And if somebody reads it and feels that they are learning something about a new society, great. But I think that a novel and the craft of it is quite distinct from reading, let's say, you know, a book about Indian politics or reading the news about India. So I would disagree that a novel can be, you know, boiled down to its message or anything like that. I think it exceeds that, but it can certainly be part of someone's reading.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I boiled this novel down to the message, but I think it's an important book precisely because of what it does delve into.
I'm glad you read it so carefully and thinking so much about contemporary. It sounds like you've been reading, you know, the news about what's happening in that country. And yeah, I appreciate your bringing that to bear as you are reading this book.
Another thing about A Burning, well, first of all, I want to ask you, why do you call it A Burning?
Well, there is a very literal burning which gets the story started. There is an attack on a train. And I also hoped that it might be interpreted as speaking about the flames of extremism that were being fanned around the nation.
What you spoke about before was, you know, the aspirations that people have, and the aspirations that poor people have. One thing that often, you know, books or, if you will, writings with messages have is they don't give the poor agency the way this book does. They don't show that people resist injustice, that their dreams for a better life, you know, when they're thwarted, people fight back. And I wonder if you could, you know, talk about how your characters, how Lovely and Jeevan, how Jeevan's parents fight back.
So in the book, you know, Lovely, for instance, is somebody who is very acquainted with the oppressions of the state, and she's very acquainted with the daily humiliations that come her way. And yet she has this kind of light and buoyant spirit, which is difficult to suppress. And that's part of why I found it really a joyous process writing about her. And same with Jeevan and her parents. They are people who are often denied opportunities to progress by the state, but they find their own ways to try and move ahead. You know, her mother, for instance, sets up this little business selling breakfast when her father no longer has work. So I think, I mean, that is just a very fundamental thing to assume about our characters, is that they have agency in all situations. You know, they wield power in ways that might not look like power, like when Lovely makes jokes or teases other people. There is power in her wielding of humor. And I hope that that comes through in the book.
And we should say that Jeevan's father can't work anymore because his back was broken from a beating that he received when their home was being torn down. So these are all things that, you know, I think give a taste of what it is like to live under a system of such injustice. You know, I wondered if you could talk a little bit also about the party. Because, as you say, it's an extreme party, but it presents itself as caring for the poor, of using the language of populism in order to manipulate the dreams and hopes of the voters. This was an interesting tension in the book, and I had myself wondering, well, does this party actually deliver? What are the contradictions being teased out here?
That's a good question. You know, I imagine that this party as doing exactly what you're saying, is, you know, appealing to the people, kind of playing up the ways in which they have served the poor, you know, making affordable rice available, for instance, and that kind of thing. And I hope that through that benevolent face and through the party's simultaneous cultivation of P.T. Sir as somebody who can, as a school teacher, bring it a facade of again, you know, respectability, legitimacy, while the work that he does is morally very corrupt, I hope that all of those contradictions help make the party an instrument that is persuasive within the book, you know, that shows how for people to come together and do evil things, they don't have to be flat villains, you know, they don't have to be instantly recognizable bad people, that they can put on a benevolent and respectable face, and that it can be a very quiet, very slow, very long process of seizing power and using it.
Finally, I'm going to read Majumdar, I'd like to read just a very short section of the book. In this is a flashback when Jeevan is with her parents. They've moved to the city. The water is really, you know, rusty, it's terrible. And they keep on being promised that it's going to get better. And of course, nothing ever happens until Jeevan speaks up. And she challenges the manager, and they get clean water. And her mother is so proud of her. And she says, so later in the quiet of the kitchen, after we'd eaten Jivan's mother, said to me, because it's in the first person, the system doesn't always work for us, but you see that now and then you can make good things happen for yourself. And I thought, only now and then? I thought I would have a better life than that.
Well, I'm so glad that that part spoke to you. I think, you know, it was part of writing Jivan's ambition, her unwillingness to settle for what her parents had settled for, her determination to create a more comfortable life for them, her determination to rise up into the middle class. And I think that kind of refusal to be in your place, that refusal to accept, you know, unfortunate circumstances as your lot in life, I mean, that is the beginning of her ambition.
Well, it's a powerful novel. It's a tragedy, you know, tragedy in the sense of a literary genre. Was that something that you had set out to write? I mean, this is your first novel. The tragic genre is it's a difficult one. What are some of your thoughts on writing a tragedy of this kind?
You know, I was thinking about the shape of the narrative, and I knew that it would have some upward movement and some downward movement without giving too much away. And I wanted to be brave in confronting what I thought the outcome in these stories would be. You know, I did not want to write wish fulfillment where the truth of this society and the truth of these circumstances are distorted so that characters can get their way. I wanted to explore what might really happen and be a little courageous in exploring that.
And you did. And I want to thank you so much, Megha Majumdar. A Burning is an impressive piece of work. It's a New York Times bestseller as well. You're getting great success with it. And I look forward to more wonderful books from you.
Thank you so much for your careful, thoughtful, deep engagement, Francesca. It's such fun to chat with somebody who has read it so generously. Thank you.
Megha Majumdar. Listen to an excerpt from A Burning by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, a book about five remarkable girls in rural Maine. Stay tuned after the break. And welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. The usual picture we get of rural America is of regions sunk into poverty and despair, overridden by the opioid crisis and gripped by anti-immigrant right-wing politics. But when Gigi Georges moved to rural Maine, she found a much more nuanced story. There was a lot of poverty, yes, and there was some addiction. But there was also a tight-knit community, strong women and girls, caring teachers, and new immigrants who were welcomed. In her book, Down East, Georges follows five remarkable young women from the community, high school students, as they negotiate the maze of coming of age in their community. Their stories reveal surprising truths about rural America and offer hope for its future. Gigi Georges has taught political science at Boston College, served as program director for the Harvard Kennedy School's Innovation Strategies Initiative, and worked as a former White House special assistant to the president. Well, Gigi Georges, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's great to be here.
So this book, Down Easter, Five Maine Girls and the Unseen Story of Rural America, is really interesting. You know, often people, when we think of rural America, we think of the Midwest. But you've chosen to place this book in rural Maine in Washington County. First, set the scene for us. Where is Washington County and what's it like?
So Washington County is on the edge of Maine's coast, going up northward. It's about an hour north of Acadia, which is probably one of the best known parts of Maine. And it is very extremely isolated. It has tremendous challenges with poverty and many of the associated challenges that come with that. But it is also stunningly beautiful.
You moved there, what is it, about 15 years ago?
Yes, my husband and I, you know, I was born and raised a city kid in Brooklyn, New York, and spent most of my life, I was, you know, surrounded by this big Greek immigrant family in Brooklyn, and went on to spend, you know, a good part of my early to mid adulthood in urban places working on urban issues. But about 15 years ago, my husband and I decided to make a move to northern New England. And ended up in New Hampshire and in Southwest Harbor, Maine, which is where we've had a home for about 15 years now.
And what actually brought you there?
A number of things. One is that the work, my work, brought us northward. I ended up doing a fellowship during the pursuit of my doctorate degree in public policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard. So we sort of made our way to the Boston area, but quickly found that we wanted to spend more time and raise our daughter in particular in a more rural place. My husband had ties to Maine, had been going there and spending time there for many years. And he said, look, why don't we just spend more time there and expose our daughter more to life in this rural surrounding? And I was really drawn to it, drawn to the beauty of it, drawn to the nature of it, drawn to all those things we think about when we think about Maine. But more than that, I was drawn to this idea, having worked for many, many years around urban education issues and in city schools and around city schools. I was drawn to this idea that there was something about life for rural kids, for young people, that I wanted to understand more about, I wanted to learn more about, I wanted to bring my own vantage point to. And I started to look around. And what I saw was something in terms of rural life that was very different from what I was hearing in the sort of dominant narrative that we all hear so much about around rural America as a place of hopelessness and despair. And I wanted to look more into that.
You take up the stories of these five girls, Audrey, Willow, Vivian, McKenna, and Josie. Why did you want to tell their stories?
Well, I came upon these girls by going to Downeast Washington County, which, as I said earlier, is about an hour up the road from Acadia, where we are in Southwest Harbor. I came upon these girls by really first spending some time at the local high school. I was so fortunate to have this introduction by a local reverend friend of ours who we come to know, who runs a wonderful nonprofit called the Maine Seacoast Mission that works with youth in Washington County and the Maine Islands, all of very remote places. And I went over to the high school and the principal said, you know, just spend some time with the kids. You're welcome to do some informal focus groups. And I did. And I started talking to boys and girls, young men and women. And out of those conversations came these five young women who were, frankly, both women I was interested in learning more about. And I'm sure we'll get a little more into their stories, but also they were willing to have this, you know, outsider come in and hang out with them and spend time with them. And they were really terrific. And that's sort of how I came upon these. And these five young women, I think, exemplify in many ways life in down East Washington County, but more broadly, sort of a microcosm of what the journeys that young women are taking and the voices of young women in rural America across the country.
Yeah, so introduce us to them. I mean, we'll go more deeply into some of their stories, but introduce us to them and why each one is a representative, as you say, of the microcosm of rural America.
Sure. So Josie is a young woman who is now a senior at Yale University, going into her senior year. She's an artist. She was classic valedictorian of her high school in down East Washington County, a very small school. And she was actually the second student ever to be admitted to and attend Yale from the high school. The first, interestingly enough, was her older sister. So it's a really interesting family. She is not a multi-generational Down Easter, where many, many are multi-generational families, as you often find in rural America. And she is sort of represents in some ways, you know, obviously that rising star, but also someone who has one foot in her old life and another in her new, and is working to reconcile the distinct worlds of Down East and Yale. McKenna, the second young woman, is a gifted softball pitcher, but is also so notable because she is a lobster fishing captain, one of the few female lobster fishing captains. It's becoming more and more common, but it's still very much a trailblazing field. She's been hauling lobsters since she could walk, basically. And she, when she finishes high school, is sort of torn between this idea of going to college and pursuing full-time lobster fishing. And this is a common theme as well, for sure. You can make really good money lobster fishing full-time, but her parents and her teachers are encouraging her to get that degree. And she goes back and forth on that and ultimately makes a choice there and a decision there. Willow is the third. She grew up in a really difficult situation, physically abusive dad. The father has been addicted to opioids and then heroin. She moves seven times before she's 8 years old and really deals with all of those really difficult challenges that we hear so much about and see so much among young people, not just in rural America, but in so many different parts of the country and elsewhere. And she searches for stability and makes her way and finds a great deal of support in community, in the mentorship of her teachers, in particular one art teacher who's so dynamic, and really tries to find a path where she doesn't repeat the cycle of her childhood. Vivian is the fourth. She comes from an established multi-generational Down East family, and she is a talented writer. Some of her writings are in the book, and they're just, I think, beautiful and speak to, I think, adolescent young women very powerfully. So she struggles a little bit emotionally and also rebels against the values of her church and town and tries to find her way through that. Finally, Audrey Barton. Audrey is dynamic. She is a beloved high school basketball star. She graduates at the top of her class and she takes her team, the basketball team, to the state championship in 2016 and becomes a sort of local hero. She represents this really interesting sort of path and set of decisions around staying or going that we hear so much about in stories of rural places. She earns a scholarship to Bates College, a great school. But once she's there, she finds there's a mismatch between what she wants to do, which is go home, work in the community, live in the community, and what Bates is offering her.
Yeah, that's great. And they're all such wonderful characters. I mean, they're real people, but wonderful characters. Talking about Willow and Vivian, they have very different backgrounds, but they shared a lot too, and shared some real struggles with Willow with the abuse, Vivian with some mental illness and upheaval in the family. Talk a little bit about their bond and how they helped each other.
They are just such a wonderful set of best friends. They got to know each other in first grade. And as you said, both have struggles that they deal with, particularly as they enter into their teenage years. And they form this bond where Vivian and her family take Willow in when she really has nowhere stable to live. And Willow lives with them for a time. And they lean on and support each other. And they find in this bond sort of something very interesting where Vivian, who has this established family, and although it is a family of divorce, and her father is remarried, and there are some challenges around that in terms of the relationship between her dad and her mom, and she gets caught in the middle of it. She is in a very stable situation, and yet she ends up being the really reckless one. She finds this path in her teenage years in particular, where she's questioning everything. She is sneaking out. She's doing all of those things that are extremely reckless when we think about teenage behavior. And she's also struggling with some demons around, as you said, mental illness as a legacy in her family. She finds an outlet in writing, but she also finds the support of Willow, who is dealing with so many difficulties of her own. And while you might think that Willow would be the reckless one, she ends up being really a rock for Vivian and the nurturer and the sort of mom figure. And so they each help each other. And their friendship to this day is just something that is so gorgeous and so textured and so layered and wonderful to see.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Gigi Georges. She's the author of the book Down East, Five Maine Girls and the Unseen Story of Rural America. Vivian's poem, I just will read a brief piece of it here and then ask you about it. This is just a little bit. Never disturb the moss. It takes 7 years to heal. And someday you may be healing and you will understand. There may only be 7 minutes. Hurry, savor, do not disturb the moss. Instead, kiss the ground. You are here to fall in love with who you are and everything there is. This poem won a medal, and then she wrote a memoir that also won a prize. How did this happen?
So she, as you can tell, I think just from that very little snippet of what she writes, she is just an incredibly soulful writer and has this beautiful way of expressing what she's going through. She found in the art teacher at the local high school, Britt Francis, who is endearingly known by all in the school as Franny, she found this wonderful mentor who saw her talent, who nurtured it, who spent time with her well beyond what we typically think of. And we see this right so often in these teachers who are so special and who play such an important role in young people's lives. This was Franny for Vivian. Franny took her under her wing and she explored so much with her in terms of Vivian's feelings, her perspective, her outlook, her worldview, her struggles, encouraged her to write, and not only encouraged that, encouraged her strongly to put herself in these competitions. And Vivian resisted it at first. And she said, they're just not good enough. And Franny said, you keep doing this and you will be ready for it. When you're ready for it, we will do it. And Vivian came around. And I think it was just such a lovely unfolding of this teacher-student relationship of really taking someone by the hand who had this self-doubt, who had these demons that she was struggling with, and encouraging her not only in her writing, but in her living to find her path and to find the way to express herself that made her feel more sure of herself and confident in what she wanted.
Yes, you know, it really struck me. She wasn't the only mentor teacher there. I mean, it sounds like a really wonderful school in a community that's one of the poorest communities, poorest counties in the country. There was also the teacher Anne Marie. Vivian and Josie joined the civil rights team that was started by this teacher, a civil rights team in the high school. This is in a very conservative community. How and why did this come about, and what was the reaction?
Yeah, this was a great story. And Anne Marie Whalen in the book, who's the English teacher, is another example of this tremendous power of teaching and mentorship and in this very small school. And I will say, I want to talk about that, but one of the really interesting things about both Anne Marie and Britt Francis, Franny, is that these two teachers came from away, as they say in Maine. They are not multi-generational. They came and found Down East as teachers later in life and fell in love with not only the beauty, but the community itself and the opportunity to help nurture and shape these young people. And so there they are working side by side with some incredibly talented and committed multi-generational teachers. And this is one of the key themes of the book, right? Around this coming together and strength of community. So Anne Marie and another colleague at the school, they decide that they're going to see if the students are interested in forming a civil rights team. And as you said, it is a rather conservative community. It's a traditional community. In many ways, this was a risky endeavor. But what they found was that the students craved this, and that from the very first meeting, students came and they said, I want to be a part of this, and I want to embrace these issues. And they took on some really terrific issues around the LGBTQ community, around race, around immigration, and continue to do so to this day, and found that when they encouraged, they encountered resistance, which they did in some parts, and that's a reality, that they were able to prevail and that they were able to win over other students and that they were able to turn heads and have folks not only in the school but in the community stand with and for them and what they were pushing and pursuing.
And you also talk, well, as it's right up in the title too, The Unseen Story of Rural America, I mean, you talk about the changes and the pressures on rural America, this region. You know, the fishing industry is really at the heart. I mean, it suffered some real pressures that maybe we can talk about from overfishing, but it's still at the center of this community. It's a source of pride, but also of patriarchy. So, you know, you mentioned McKenna. Say a little bit more about how she achieved being a captain, and then about the larger role that women hold. You say women hold a central role there, even though it's a community with a lot of machismo.
Yes. So this was a great I think, storyline that emerged and was so apparent even from the first days that I spent time there. And I had the really, really good fortune to be able to go out with McKenna a few times, as well as Olivia Marshall, who is essentially McKenna's mentor and role model as a lobster boat fishing captain, as well as the basketball coach at the high school. I went out lobster fishing with each of them, and served as their sternman. I'm a pretty poor sternman at that. They were very patient with me, but I really learned, and I learned how really tough that work is. I saw in this very, as you say, seemingly male-dominated area and field that perceptions of that were not quite matched up to reality, that women play a tremendously strong central role in the community. And women are achieving tremendous heights in the field of lobster fishing. They are emerging. McKenna is this great example of this generation of young women who are looking at lobster fishing as something that they not only can break into, but that they can be leaders in. And she learns at the knee of her dad and her older brothers. She is passionate about lobster fishing from the age of 8. And she says, "Dad, I want to go out there. I want to fish." And he's putting her off for a little while. And finally, he says, "Okay, it's time. Let's go." And they go out, and she is so skilled, and she is a quick learner, and she's strong. She's a beautiful young woman, and she is strong, and she takes it on and makes it a major centerpiece in her growing life. Her family is very supportive. Her dad is extremely supportive, and she's out there with the men just doing it and doing it really well. And it is a great theme in the book, but it is also part of that larger theme of the way in which young women in places like Down East, Washington County, are really excelling and are playing central roles, leading in academics, leading in athletics, taking on leadership roles in the community, and doing it side by side with the men, and in a way that the men are really supporting them. And I think that that does run counter to that dominant narrative we keep hearing about, right? In ways that a few other themes that I came across ran counter to that dominant narrative that we keep hearing about around rural America.
Yes, I mean, we do hear the narrative of deindustrialization and poverty, and that's certainly something that's true there. And you found a lot of the stresses in the community, but also the strengths, including the strength of increasing diversity. So I wonder if you could talk about that, of the immigrants who have been welcomed, and then also, you know, leave us with the final, you know, the strengths and the lessons that you derived from writing this book, Down East, Five Maine Girls and the Unseen Story of Rural America.
Well, Francesca, I found this very interesting and sort of really optimistic strand around the way in which various strands of the community are standing side by side and working together to strengthen their communities. As you said, places like Down East Washington County face tremendous challenges. There is a significant poverty there. In Washington County, 30% has 30% childhood poverty, which is very high. It struggles with opioid addiction, which unfortunately we see in so much of rural America as well as suburban and urban America. You know, access to healthcare is really tough. Access to mental health facilities, domestic abuse shelters. There are so many issues that are being contended with. At the same time, you see some really strong things happening. And one of those, as you mentioned, is you have a farm worker and immigrant community that stems out of many farm workers who have come to work on blueberry harvests, because blueberries are a big thing up in Washington County. And many of these farm workers have looked around and made a decision to settle there as families. And so you have migrant and immigrant families who have settled in this area. And they have found many of the same things that I saw to celebrate, the strength of community, the school that is really caring and nurturing, the opportunities to thrive and grow. And what I saw was immigrant families, multi-generational families, families of those teachers from away, like Franny and Anne-Marie Whalen, side by side working to strengthen their communities. And that is not to say that there aren't moments, right, where you do have some discord and some working through. But by and large and overwhelmingly, I saw some really, really great standing together, working together, and looking to build.
Well, that's terrific. And it's just been really great to talk with you, Gigi Georges, about this book. It's so interesting, about a community that so few people know about. The stories of these five main girls are really fascinating. The book is Down East. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Gigi Georges. Read an excerpt from Down East at writersvoice.net. And coming up next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Elizabeth Hinton about her book, America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. And we also talk with Julia Zweig about her book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.